This is a special feature produced for download from ABC Classic FM's website. Due to copyright restrictions on the music, it's been edited to make this possible.
Margaret Throsby with you on ABC Classic FM. When did you last go to the dentist? What stops you lifting the phone and making an appointment? For some it's fear, of course, but for a great many it's the cost. About half the population of Australia can't afford to go to the dentist. But the public system is swamped with a staggering 650,000 on waiting lists and a handful of dentists to attend to them. So people's teeth deteriorate. And here's the shocking statistic. At least 30,000 Australians are hospitalised every year with preventable dental infection. We've got lousy teeth by the sound of it, and we've got lousy dental care. So what's to be done? Well, Hans Zollner has a lot to say about this. He's Associate Professor of Oral Pathology and Oral Medicine. I wrote on my notes that he was the Associate Professor of Moral Medicine, but it's actually Oral Medicine at the University of Sydney. He's hot under the collar about all of this entire topic, oral health, what and how it goes bad, and crucially, how's the best way to make sure all Australians can gain access to good dental care. Hans Zollner joins us this morning. The usual drill applies. He's chosen music for all of us to listen to in the next hour. Nigel Westlake, music called Penguin Play from Antarctica, the Tasmanian Symphony conducted by David Porcelain and chosen by our guest today, Associate Professor Hans Zollner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm really delighted to be here.
We had a waiting list for getting you in here. I know it's hard to get into people's diaries, but I'm glad you're here. I want you to tell us why you chose that first.
Oh, look, really just because it's beautiful, really. I mean, every time I've heard it, it's just, you can't help but bring it, it brings a smile to your lips. No matter when you hear it, and I must say that if I'm feeling a little bit down or a bit weary, if I put this on, I feel a lot pepped up.
Well, that's good, because I bet this gets a bit of a workout when you're thinking about the dental health schemes, various ones that we've had and might have in Australia. Can we get onto that a little bit later? Because I'd like to start, because there are two branches to this story. One is dental health, oral health. I guess we should say oral health, not just dental, because it's teeth and gums and mouth.
Mm.
And the other is how we get access to the treatment. I've read that we're at the bottom or in the bottom third of OECD countries when it comes to dental health. Is that right?
Well, yes, that's right. But I think the thing is that it's really important to remember that that's actually reflecting an average of two Australias. There's one Australia that has access to good dental services. If you can afford dental services, the care that you get is actually pretty good. We actually have very good standards of dentistry in this country. If you can get in, if you can be seen, you'll be well looked after and your dental health will be outstanding. On the other hand, if you're part of that significant part of the population that simply cannot afford to pay for a dentist, or you can't get into the public system, or alternatively there are no dentists in your area, if you live out in the bush, for example, it's fine, you might have the money, but you can't find a dentist for love of money, well then basically your dental health will degenerate and you will have nothing. So this OECD average thing is really an average. There are two Australias, one with dentistry and one without.
All right. Well, we'll come to that in a moment. But the ones that without, what are the implications of having poor dental or oral health?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the obvious things, I mean, the most common dental disease is dental decay, dental caries. And the there is a tendency for people to think that, oh, well, decay is all about just, you know, black teeth or a bit unsightly or might cause a toothache. But there's little understanding, I suppose, in the general population, understandably, that in fact it's just the start of the disease. The top part of the tooth is like an iceberg. You can see the tip of the iceberg, but most of the iceberg is under the water level. And the same with teeth. Most of the tooth is below the gum line. So bacteria get into the top of the tooth through the decay process, then they get inside of the tooth in this sort of hollow chamber that contains blood vessels and nerves, and then they destroy the nerve and the blood vessels, and they grow down through this hollow chamber into the bone that supports the teeth. And so now you've got bacteria and sometimes even food debris and stuff, saliva, crap, getting down into the bone, into the bone of your jaw.
Into your actual bone.
Into the actual bone. And this is like when dentists take x-rays, quite often they're looking for signs that the bone has been destroyed, because that's what happens. The bone is destroyed and then you can get cysts. But then the infection tends to spread from the bone into the adjacent soft tissues. So you get, you know, swellings in your face or under your neck. Now, those infections can be pretty serious. I mean, before antibiotics were available, people commonly used to die of toothache. It was a common thing. You know, like Les Darcy, you know, the boxer, you know, that fit young man, ultra-fit sportsman, died of sepsis from an infected tooth. Used to be common, you know, at the turn of the century, that's how people died.
Good heavens, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, we don't do that so much these days because we have antibiotics and many of us can afford decent dentistry. However, for those who cannot afford dentistry, who cannot get service, well, what can they do? They can go to a doctor and they can get a script for antibiotics. The doctor can't treat the tooth, so the infection comes back. And so they, you know.
Is the doctor prohibited from treating the tooth or just doesn't have the knowledge?
Or doesn't have the skills. Okay. And, you know, a medical practitioner, they don't have the training.
So you go, if you can't afford to go to the dentist, you've got a blown-up jaw, you go to the doctor, he or she prescribes an antibiotic, and that settles it down, presumably.
Well, very often it settles it down. Usually it does, and the patient feels better, and there's an illusion that you're ahead of the game. The trouble is that it'll come back. Every time the infection comes back, you're now more resistant to those antibiotics. And in fact, this repeated prescription of antibiotics for preventable dental infection is one of the things that's driving us into the post-antibiotic era. The antibiotics will stop working, partly, not only because, but partly because we're too lousy to put dentistry into Medicare.
Okay, we'll come to that. But can I be devil's advocate? Fluoridation fixed all the cavities up, didn't it?
Well, I mean, that's unfortunately one of the problems that we have is that governments in the not-that-distant past were lulled into a sense of false security about fluoridation. Fluoride does reduce the rate of dental decay. And what happens is that you end up with more teeth in your mouth. But the trouble is that the rate of decay is brought down from so many decayed teeth, say 5 decayed teeth, down to 2 decayed teeth. You've still got 2 decayed teeth.
And that still presents the problems you said. Won't bone regenerate if it's been destroyed by dental problems?
Well, the bone will regenerate. You can actually get recovery and all, but the trouble is that it may not. And of course, if the infection is serious enough, you can have life-threatening infection. And then there's the other group of diseases, periodontal disease, which is affects about 20% of the population. Around 5% of the population will lose their teeth because of periodontal disease.
What's periodontal disease?
Oh, that's a disease where the gums basically sort of break down. So the bone and gum tissue that supports the roots of the teeth break down. A bacterial plaque grows down along it. You form these so-called pockets. Depends on, there are different presentations, but essentially the teeth get loose and fall out of your head. Mm. Now, there's a weird association between periodontal disease and, for example, worse control of diabetes.
So, why is that?
Well, you know, the basis for it's a bit unclear, but it's certainly known that if you've got any active infection, your diabetic control is worse. Okay, and there are well-described stress mechanisms that detail that. But it seems, and it's also known that diabetes, for example, makes dental infection worse, and there are potential mechanisms for that relating to changes in the blood vessels, changes in the white blood cells.
So it's a vicious circle.
It's a vicious circle, and so unless you treat the dental infection, you get worse diabetes, unless you can, you know, and so you need to break that cycle by treating the dental infection. But there's also a funny relationship, well, it's not funny. Funny is the wrong word.
Funny, weird, yes.
Funny, weird relationship between dental infection, particularly periodontal disease, and heart disease and stroke, for example, and low birth weight children. And, you know,
really?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, it was controversial at first. Now the statistical data is getting to be pretty firm, in fact. Except low birth weight children, that's still a little bit wonky, but it might be true. But certainly...
What, you mean in the mother there is... Yeah. We're talking about the mother here, aren't we?
Untreated.
During pregnancy.
That's right. Untreated periodontal disease in mothers, there is an association between with preterm babies and low birth weight children.
Have you got any idea why?
Well, look, the basis for all of these associations is unclear. One theory is that, okay, perhaps it's just as simple as bacteria getting into the bloodstream and they get circulated around the body and they set up reactions wherever they land. And there's certainly some data showing that bacteria can find the way into atherosclerotic plaques, for example. And so that might provide one mechanism. But the other mechanism, and I have to say that this is my favourite theory, my preferred theory, is simply that local infection results in, well, there are well-known mechanisms that actually result in a systemic change in the body in response to a local infection. And there are special hormone-like chemicals, these cytokines, that travel from where the infection is to the liver. The liver then turns on production of a whole set of proteins, some of which are clotting factors, and these clotting factors then are well known to have a predisposition for vascular disease. And so there are at least two mechanisms, but the truth is we don't really know.
That's incredible. So who's doing the work in that research? Is it cardiologists or neonatologists or oral people or
what? Well, it's a combination, actually. There are sorts of teams of people, but mostly really dental researchers, primarily dental researchers. But yes, I mean, very often cardiologists and neonatologists and others become
involved. It's amazing that we evolved to be so vulnerable in this part of our body, isn't it? That we've got, I mean, you know, if you get an infection in your eye, for instance, your eye deals with it generally, and unless it gets really, really serious, then you're cool. But with dentists, with teeth, it's different.
Well, actually, you know, it's funny you should put it like that, because in fact, actually, there's truth that the mouth is a little bit different, but it's actually the other way around. We actually tolerate infection around the mouth much better than we would tolerate a similar infection elsewhere in the body. Orthopaedic surgeons cannot believe what we get away with in dentistry. I mean, if an orthopaedic surgeon, if they're doing an operation on somebody's femur, for example, they go to extraordinary lengths to keep the area clean, iodine and absolute sterility, and then they expose the bone, fearfully frightened that some bacteria might get in, because osteomyelitis is the most likely outcome. Mm. In dentistry, we extract teeth and food and crap gets into the socket and there's no osteomyelitis. It's uncommon to have osteomyelitis.
It's because our bodies deal with that as a routine thing.
Well, that's right, because I think the mouth is an unusually exposed site for potential infection. It's bacteria, because we have teeth protrude up from the bone through the epithelial barrier. It's the only part of the body where you actually have the epithelial barrier penetrated. There's this in immunology. We think about specific and non-specific defence mechanisms, and one of the keys non-specific defence mechanisms is that we have epithelial coverings that seal us up.
Epithelial meaning?
Or like skin or mucosa and stuff.
Right, but seal everything in.
Seal everything in so that nothing can get in from outside, so the bacteria can't get in. Generally speaking, inside the body is pretty sterile.
Mm.
Now, the mouth, on the other hand, is unusual in that teeth, because we want teeth in our mouths, teeth actually have to penetrate from the underlying bone up through this mucosal barrier.
Mm.
And there's an obvious site of potential infection. And so, in fact, we have astonishingly good defence mechanisms for dental infection.
Well, we've evolved to have that, haven't we?
We have. But of course, they can be overwhelmed. And that's what happens
and
when we have
disease. And easily are, by the sound of it. The thing is that you've pointed this out before. Dentists routinely go into people's mouths and create wounds.
Yeah.
Don't you? You're sort of picking around there and cutting and creating wounds.
Absolutely. And we routinely expose bone and we get away with it. It's amazing, really.
It really is amazing. All right. Oh, you've created more questions now, but we'll hear some music, and it's from Vivaldi. It's one of the beautiful guitar concertos. Why have you chosen this?
Oh, right. Well, look, it's a beautiful piece I've always loved it. And my wife told me a while ago that, it reminds her of a walk through Venice. And I thought, well, that sounds right. And ever since then, I always associate this with an evening very soon after we were married. We went to Venice to Europe on a honeymoon. And there was one night where Helen was just too tired to continue walking around or go out in the evening. So she stayed behind in the hotel. And I took myself off for a walk through Piazza San Marco and around the canals. And honestly, this piece of music just seems to fit the experience.
Gorgeous. The Largo from the Guitar Concerto in D by Vivaldi, one of the Romero brothers, Celine Romero, with the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, chosen by our guest, Hans Zollner, who's Associate Professor of Oral Pathology and Oral Medicine at the University of Sydney. We're talking about teeth. Just on the subject about our teeth and our health, how often should people go to the dentist, do you think, if they can?
Well, look, I mean, there used to be this thing where you said, oh, look, you should go every 6 months. That's probably not true, really. And really, you should go dependent upon your individual susceptibility. Some people have more disease and they need to be seen much more frequently. And other people, they have great teeth. And frankly, you don't need to see them more than every few years,
and
every couple of years.
If you do get a cavity, you've got to have it filled.
Yes, pretty much. I mean, the cavities tend to march inexorably forward. Now, having said that, actually, there is now good evidence that if they are treated with fluoride and if the oral habits of the person change, that relatively early cavities before, in fact, they're not real cavities, but decay before the actual surface breaks down and you've got a hole as such, that you can actually stop them from progressing. And there's one of our colleagues, Associate Professor Wendell Evans, has done some fantastic research that's really just bearing fruit now, showing that you can cut the number of fillings that have to be delivered by about a third if you instigate what he calls a caries management program. So that could be an enormous boon for us all.
Sticks, floss or brushes?
Well, you need to use all of them depending upon your personal anatomy. Like if you've got big gaps between your teeth, then quite often it's much easier to use little interdental sticks or there are little interdental brushes. On the other hand, if you've got teeth that are tightly wedged together, you really need dental floss to get between them, and you always need a dental brush, a toothbrush, to clear the bacteria from the gum line.
And how often should you brush your teeth?
Well, really at least two times a day, at least in the morning, at least at night. Electric brushes apparently do a better job than handheld brushes. When I was a student, we used to poo-poo that and we were told, an ordinary handheld brush is just as good. Actually, not quite true, actually. Turns out that electric brushes do work better.
And when should children start going to the dentist? Ideally?
That's a good
question.
With
the milk teeth or with the second teeth?
Well, look, now, with their baby teeth, you really do want to get them in there, even if they don't have any decay. As soon as they're sort of conscious and aware of what's going on, you really want to acclimatise them to the experience. They sit in the chair.
Don't tell them it's a scary thing.
No, that's right. It's not a scary thing. Although most people dread the experience, they don't really need to. It can be delivered essentially painlessly. There are very few procedures in dentistry that are really painful, that are unavoidably painful.
Okay, now let's get to this business of how we do this, because it's all very well for people listening to this program, and probably a lot of them have a dentist and they go and see them regularly and it's of no consequence. But those statistics are terrible, that 50% of Australians roughly can't go to the dentist. Mm. What are we going to do about it?
Well, we've been arguing for a long time that the most sensible thing to do is to bring dentistry into our otherwise excellent healthcare system.
Why wasn't it attached to Medicare in the first place?
Well, look, to start off with, I think all health professionals resisted Medibank when it was being introduced by the Whitlam government, and the doctors sort of won, and the doctors lost, I should say, and the dentists won. The dentists got their way and were kept out of the system.
Why didn't doctors want Medibank? Take us back to that.
Well, I think they saw at that time, and dentists still see at this time, that it's basically potentially going to change the way, well, it will obviously change the way you do practice and will force lower costs. And indeed, that is one of the effects of Medicare, that in fact actually what it does, because there's a bulk billable rebate, it does actually create the only real downward pressure on medical prices. Because, you see, if I think I'm really hot shit and that I'm worth $500 above the rebate, I can insist on a $500 gap, but it's up to the patient to decide if I'm really worth that when there's a guy around the corner who might see me for nothing, effectively, because he'll do the bulk bill thing.
Yeah.
Now that creates, in a market where there is an unlimited demand, seemingly, and a very limited supply of doctors, it creates a downward pressure on prices. It's real, and I don't see that in dentistry we have a right to demand exclusion from that simply because it might hurt the pocket.
You know, it struck me recently that dentists are one of the few practices where you really have to rely on what they're telling you is the truth, unless you can be bothered going and finding a second opinion. When you open your mouth and the dentist and they say, look, you need a crown on this back tooth, you're taking their word for it, aren't you? Another dentist might say, no, you don't need a crown at all, just stick a bit of cement on it or something. But, you've got the difference between $3,000 and $500 or $50.
It's one of the great problems that we have in dentistry, in fact, actually, and there are some studies showing, for example, that if you send the same patient round to 10 dentists, you'll get 10 wildly divergent treatment plans.
Really?
And
that can't be good.
Well, that's bad. And one of the things that we've been saying is that, I think the great majority of dentists are honest. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
But there are cowboys?
Well, there are going to be some cowboys, and there are unfortunately, there are going to be some dishonest dentists, as there are dishonest people in all professions. But more to the point is that we do not have national standards for treatment and for diagnosis of dental disease and the treatment of dental disease.
Just say that again. We don't have national standards.
National standards. So that you walk into the dentist and you've got decay that looks like this, well, then there is a treatment for decay that looks like this. This patient has these risk factors as assessed by this protocol, and therefore they should receive this optimal treatment, this treatment which is optimal for this type of patient based upon all the available evidence. And this is exactly what Associate Professor Wendell Evans is showing, that if you have very strict criteria for the diagnosis and treatment of dental decay, that in fact much of it doesn't need to be treated, that you get better health outcomes, you reduce costs, and you achieve a more reliable service, because now the dentist and the patient can be assured that so long as you're working along the guidelines as established by these national standards, you're delivering the best possible care for this patient.
It can be made as clear-cut as that, can it? Because, I mean, you know, you'd have shades of advice, wouldn't you?
Yes, well, of course, you're right. Of course, there's always going to be wriggle room, there's always going to be shades of grey. Mm. But at the moment, we have no standards, we have no clear guidelines. And
So the patient is at the mercy of the dentist, saying, you need to come to see me every week for the next 6 months, and it's going to put you back $50,000. You've got no comeback at that, unless you go to the bloke around the corner.
I mean, and most people, I think, understandably, take the advice of the expert, and that's as it should be. It's just, unfortunately, there's uncertainty amongst the experts about what the right advice should be.
Is that something that's incidental or a sort of an ancillary thing to what you're on about the scheme, or is it fundamental to it, do you think?
Well, I think it becomes fundamental to it, because when the federal government starts to get into substantially paying for dental services via Medicare, then in fact actually it comes to the stage when they start to say, well, hang on here, why is it that you do nothing but gold crowns, you do nothing but porcelain crowns, and the other guy does nothing but do amalgam fillings, and hang on, but is the guy doing amalgam fillings not doing crowns enough, or is this guy doing too many porcelains, and why no gold, and why? And in fact, actually, it means that the government has to get into the business of actually looking at what's going on in private practice.
Are they reluctant to do that?
Well, I think the profession is very reluctant for that to happen. But again, you know, that can't be the consideration in terms of our role. And I think actually, in truth, the great majority of dentists would welcome clear national standards. The great majority of dentists that I know generally are supportive of this sort of approach, but they want to make sure that it's not going to interfere with the ability to say, well, hang on, in my judgment, in this case, Mrs. Johnson needs treatment
gold, X. 14 gold crowns.
Right, well, I mean, this is sort of one of the advantages potentially out of Medicare. But going back to the question of why dentistry was excluded, back in the 70s, we knew the factors, the lifestyle factors that cause dental disease. We knew about, you know, the importance of toothbrushing. We knew about fluoride. We knew that if you have lots of sugar in your diet, you get more decay. Now, we were ahead of the game in dentistry compared with the rest of health, because it wasn't really clear, even in the early 70s, it wasn't absolutely certain that smoking really caused lung cancer. It wasn't really clear that, you know, like a sedentary lifestyle leads to ischemic heart disease. It wasn't clear that diabetes can be controlled. And systemic disease was thought of as visited upon you by Jove, like a lightning bolt, and therefore insurable because you couldn't predict it. Dentistry, on the other hand, they thought, well, we can prevent this, therefore it's predictable.
Therefore
we can't insure it. Now that thinking should change, because obviously since the 1970s we have learnt that 30% of cancers are preventable. We've learnt that certainly almost all of type 2 diabetes is preventable. We know that many heart attacks are preventable, many strokes are preventable. No one in their right mind turns around and says, well, because these things are now suddenly preventable, we're just going to let these people rot to death.
And we also know that certain things lead to dental problems and oral problems, and therefore they should be insurable because they're preventable.
Well, yes. I mean, I would say that one of the great things that we have achieved in Australia is a principle that we do not want to have to watch people die or go bankrupt because they can't afford healthcare. We've said we're going to have community-rated health insurance. We've said we're going to have Medicare. We've got public hospitals that deliver services that can't be delivered in private. And with those sorts of things, with the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, we've said, we believe we should have communal responsibility for each other's health, that we will not allow our neighbours to just waste away.
But we are with this dental situation.
But we are with dentistry. So with dentistry, we just want in. We just want into the system. We want to be part of our essentially excellent healthcare system.
You don't think we should have a separate system called DentiCare, which has been the idea's been floated, hasn't it?
Well, that idea's been floated, and it's great that there's this commission, the National Health and Hospital Reform Commission. They've recommended a DentiCare model, and it sounds like Medicare. It sounds like Medicare, but in fact, when you look at the details, it's not Medicare at all. And in fact, there are certain aspects of it that are really worrying.
So you would recommend that dentistry becomes part of Medicare, and that you'd have to whack up the Medicare what is taken out of people's salaries.
Well, you know, again, I'm not too sure if that's true. I mean, at this point in time, the Medicare levy collects only 1/7 of all the cost of the federally funded health services, 1/7 of that cost. So it's a lie to say that the Medicare levy covers our costs now. Why should we make a special dispensation for dentistry? Say, oh, no, we can only include dentistry
if we increase the levy.
Yeah, No. I mean, if that's the case, then I insist that the Medicare levy rise to cover the full cost of Medicare as well, It's a specious argument. It's going to be tax dollars one way. It doesn't really matter. But we do know that Medicare can work in dentistry because it's already been trialled. 10% of the population with chronic disease like diabetes or valvular heart disease since November 2007 are eligible today for comprehensive dental care up to the value of $2,125 a year
through
Medicare.
That was a Howard government initiative, wasn't it?
It was a Howard government initiative.
And is it quietly trotting along?
It's doing really well. There are some problems. There's clear. We see that there is need for regulation. Mm. The current government has vowed to axe the scheme. We're hoping that they've been blocked from axing the scheme by the Senate. We're hoping that they will change their mind.
Wow. Okay. What's the barcarolle from the Tales of Hoffman doing on your list?
Oh, right. Well, it's just, first of all, a beautiful piece of music. And it comes from an opera, the Tales of Hoffman. And it was a... in my previous appointment, my most recent previous appointment, that's now getting to be 15 or so years ago, I was a postdoctoral scientist in the Department of Physiology at Vienna. And it was a wonderful department. And the people there in Vienna, they were really kind to us, and when we were coming back to Australia, the lab got together and they bought these very expensive opera tickets for us to go and see the Tales
ooh,
of Hoffman.
Ooh.
Oh, it was a wonderful
what
experience.
What a fabulous present!
And there we went to the opera, and of course this piece of music comes from the Tales of Hoffman.
The barcarolle from The Tales of Hoffman by Offenbach, and it was the Vienna State Opera Orchestra, chosen by our guest today, Hans Zollner, and we're talking about oral health and the dental care system in this country. So is it fixable, in your opinion?
Oh, yes, of course it's fixable. I mean, you know, this is a small
650,000 people waiting, though.
Well, yes, but that's because they're waiting for the public dental service, you see. I mean, less than 10% of the nation's dentists work in the public system.
But why can't we attract dentists to the public system?
Well, because there's a workforce shortage and you can make a lot of money in private practice, and why would you work for the public system when you can work in private practice instead? And in truth, it's more or less that way across all health professions. Mm. The difference is that there is no Medicare cover for people for dental services, and so those people, almost half of the population who are unable to afford dental services, also happen to be eligible for public dental services. So what do? They're trying to line up to get into the public system. The 650,000 people on the waiting list, that's a spurious number, because many millions of people should be seen by the public system. They don't even bother to sign up. They've got no serious expectation of ever getting to the front of the queue. They know, especially the older ones, they're going to die before they get seen. Mm. Why bother? So they don't. And I can understand that. So this is what happens when you've got a tiny part of the workforce trying to see much of the population. If you had Medicare, then all of those people would flood out into the private system and get their teeth seen there.
Yeah, I get you. How did you get into dentistry? Is that a good question? I mean, are you from a family of dentists?
No, not at all. I'm the first person in my family to go to university or anything like that. No, I mean dentistry was sort of a bit of an accident for me. I was really, I mean, when I was a kid, I decided very early on that I wanted to do research. I wanted to be a scientist. I wanted to discover things, and I wanted to know how plants grew and what made animals work and understand, you know, what happens when cells move and what the hell is a cell. I was interested in that. I was absolutely, you know, actually a bit of a monomaniac. I was going to do research. And growing up, you sort of realise that, well, actually, it's good to have money as well. that you know, research can be a... Even as a kid, you could see that research could be a tenuous existence, that if you run out of grant money or something, that that you could be a bit stuck. And so I thought, OK, look, I'll do medicine or something, and that'll be a way to earn money, and then I can fund my own research and I don't have to worry about grants and stuff. As fate would have it, I didn't, you know, I missed out on getting into medicine.
Did dentistry.
Yeah, did dentistry. And I thought, well, this is okay. I mean, you know, I do all the basic sciences as well and learn to use my hands, which isn't a bad thing to do. And so I did dentistry, and that's more or less what I did. I completed dentistry, and after a few years' practice, went back and did the research training and have continued from there.
Very interesting, very interesting. Now, your research, I thought we'd play some music now, and then, because I really wanted to leave some time to talk about the research you do, which is in blood, isn't it, and cells and all of that. And I want you to, I've been reading it, and I find it incredibly interesting, and I hope I can ask the right questions about it. But let's hear the next piece of music now, and then we'll get into that. This is from the musical Rent. Tell us about this.
Oh, right. Well, look, again, this is Rent. It's a musical that we only recently saw. My wife and I went to New York related to a conference, and when we were there, we saw Rent. And it's basically about these artists who are struggling, and half of them are suffering with AIDS, and other ones are they're all impoverished. And there's this one character who sings this particular song, one song, Glory, and it's really quite striking because it speaks so strongly of he knows he's going to die. He's very, very sick, but he wants to do one good thing with his life, and he's going to write this one song. And throughout the musical, he falls in love with this character called Mimi. It's taken from La Boheme, and it was when I saw these characters, I thought, crumbs, I've seen Mimi dancing, because some years before that, I'd been to New York before the Giuliani era had started. Mm. And New York was had a bit of an edge, you know. There was a bit of a sense of frisson, you know. There was a mugging in Times Square that I walked past. Oh, great, okay, this is New York. Watch myself a bit. And on the 4th of July, we happened to be there for the 4th of July, and a group of us went down to share the 4th of July with the New Yorkers at Battery Point, and it was just a wonderful experience. And walking back to the hotel late at night from this, everyone's on the streets, celebrating the 4th of July, and there was this most beautiful young girl, but she looked ill. She really did look ill, and she was dancing her life away, and just for that moment, I thought, crumbs, this kid is, she's just living in the moment, and she's just having this moment of bliss, dancing on the street. And when I saw Rent, I thought, crumbs, it's Mimi, because Mimi's the dancer, and she's dying, and her whole theme is, I'm living in the moment.
Okay, here it is. This is called One Song Glory from Rent. That's Adam Pascal and One Song Glory from Rent, and singing the role of Roger there, and chosen by our guest today, Hans Zollner. So we've found out why you did dentistry, because you wanted to do research. What is your research? Can you put it into a nutshell for us?
Right. Well, I'm sort of interested in this sort of question of how cells arrange themselves to form large-scale structures. I mean, it's actually, when you look under the microscope, tissues are beautiful. I mean, the way that cells are arranged, histology is a study of microvascular of microstructure of tissues, and I remember as a second year dental student, we all were sort of chained to a microscope for so many months, sort of drawing pictures of things on the microscope, and many of my colleagues just couldn't stand it. But for me, it was just wonderful, because you got to sit there and really look carefully at how it all fits together and how the cells come together. And I remember looking down the microscope at the liver, and the liver, I just fell in love with the thing. It's the most beautiful regular structure, and it's a vascular structure.
It's different from a vascular structure elsewhere in the body.
Well, it's got this sort of hexagonal structure. It's got the liver lobules have got sort of this broad hexagonal structure. And what was striking, when you sort of sit there and look at it and think about it, what was striking is that, okay, you've got this regular pattern, and what really struck me also is that it's a vascular organ. And in fact, actually, the pattern's defined by where the blood vessels are. Mm. And then you think about it, well, actually, when you look at this pattern and you sort of look at each hexagon, it's like a honeycomb. If you move sideways from a hexagon in a honeycomb, you can predict exactly where the next hexagon mm-hmm. will be. But what was interesting was that the further you go away from that central starting hexagon, if you will, the less predictable that becomes. And what I realised was, okay, there must be like a pattern generating mechanism here, but superimposed upon the pattern generating mechanism that positions each blood vessel where it belongs, there then has to be some sort of local signal. So there's a communication between local signals and an underlying pattern generator. And that sort of fascinated me. And in truth,
is it an electrical signal?
Well, there might be electrical signals. I mean, it's a wonderful question, Margaret. You should do science because I mean, that's
well,
the thing.
Well, signal to me suggests passing of information from one place to another. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's precisely the point because, in fact, these cells, they communicate with each other in such a way that they spontaneously form these large-scale vascular structures. And it's quite an achievement. When you look at, say, an artery running down to form this myriad of capillaries that now and then forming a venule and draining out as a vein, all that large-scale structure, which functions as perfect plumbing, it's a perfect plumbing system. There's nothing superfluous, there's nothing wasted. It just functions beautifully to supply blood to the tissues. That huge structure is comprised of individual little cells, each of which can only see the immediate cell immediately adjacent to it. So they're all blind.
See inverted commas.
That's right. They can only communicate with the cell immediately next to it, and yet somehow they are able to form this enormous complex pattern.
And is there a similarity, or is there an analogy to be drawn by a flock of birds?
Well, perhaps, but another thing is a bit like, I like to think of like road networks. Imagine you've got, you're establishing a road network without any planning. There's no intelligent conscience planning where the road should go. It just happens spontaneously. The bricks arrange themselves.
You mean during our formation in the womb?
During our formation during development or during formation in the wounds or anything, or whenever the tissues have to change. You know what it's like here in Sydney. If they want to change the road network in Sydney, well, the guys with the hard hats are there and the stop-go signs and all the traffic stops and it's a bit of a mess, but eventually it gets fixed and the traffic flows again. In living tissues, that has to happen all the time. But there's blockage
no
in
overseer.
Flow. There's no overseer. And not only that, but
the
system...
Not that we're aware of.
Oh, well, there doesn't appear to be, but there's certainly... no traffic chaos. There's no traffic chaos in the microcirculation when it remodels. It just happens in such a way that the tissues are perpetually perfused perfectly with blood, adapting to the fact that...
With just enough blood.
With just the right amount of blood. And all happening without any conscious supervision and happening in such a way that the cells can only communicate immediately with the cells immediately adjacent. So that's what I've been looking at in different ways
over
these years.
Have you had any under-the-shower aha experiences?
Well, yes, it's funny you should put it like that. Of course, yes, I have. And what we've discovered is that the cells that form the blood vessels, these endothelial cells, they're called endothelial cells, they form like a flattened layer of cells that form the tubes, right? And it seems that every blood vessel, every endothelial cell in our body is screaming out for death. They're all sitting there with a knife to their
screaming
own throat.
Screaming out for death.
For death. They want to commit suicide. They want to die. They will, in fact, die by this process called apoptosis. It's sort of cellular suicide, and which is the mechanism for removing excessive cells from the body. And what they do is that they look constantly for signals from the environment to say that they are part of a useful functional microvascular network. So if, for example, if there's blood flowing past them, that's one signal saying, OK, there's blood flowing
past. So don't commit suicide right
now. Don't commit suicide because you're still useful. If you're, on the other hand, if you get detached, if there's trauma and the cell is detached from the wall of the blood
vessel. Now's the time to commit suicide because otherwise you might cause problems somewhere else.
Exactly. You might even block the blood vessels downstream. and one of the things that we stumbled across actually looking at exactly this question, what happens to the blood, to the cells that get detached, is that we found, interestingly enough, that the endothelial cells have special adaptations that allow them to become physically small, because you see the size of a single endothelial cell is really very big, and it's much bigger than a capillary. So if large numbers of endothelial cells get shed into the circulation, they just block the vessels. So we've found, for example, that they form these interesting canalicular structures and break up. But we've also found what the thing that we're really chasing as hard as we can right now is that there's one plasma protein, it's serum albumin, it's A protein, and we've discovered that it is one of the key signals that the endothelial cells are looking for. And it's interesting that the molecule actually has to sort of be, it's a wriggly protein. The thing is, it's sort of like, it's just a crazy kicking stochastic molecule that's always exposing bits of itself in a rather risque way. And one little bit that it exposes, just maybe one once every 10 hours, it might just kick into the right shape that exposes a site that binds a receptor on the endothelial cells that says, no, stay alive, you dare not die. And so we've been trying to understand how that works.
Jigsaw puzzle, in every sense of the word.
Oh, it's a wonderful question.
It's a fantastic piece of research. I can see a Nobel Prize down the line somewhere. But we've got to finish now because we want to hear just a little of your last choice, which is Beethoven, Pastoral Symphony.
Yes.
Tell us why.
Oh, right. Well, it's a piece of music I was introduced when I was an undergraduate student. One of my friends was, a very gifted musician, actually, and loved Beethoven. And he introduced me to this piece. And I remember him explaining, well, this movement is like when Beethoven is sitting in a carriage and going out to the countryside, and the excitement of going to the countryside. And then and later on when we went to Vienna and I was working there, I always thought of this, and I thought, well, actually, that's exactly right. You're leaving the grey city and you're going into this beautiful Viennese countryside. And so that's
why what it's about. It gives us a taste, doesn't it? The first movement, just the opening of the Pastoral Symphony by Beethoven, played by the Vienna Philharmonic under Sir Simon Rattle. Final choice of our guest today, Associate Professor Hans Zollner from Sydney University. Now, tomorrow, John Gaydon, who's about to open next week in King Lear in Adelaide. And looking at next week, James Fallows on Monday, American journalist, one of the Nader's raiders, and Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter, in fact. James Fallows on Monday. Don Watson on Tuesday, another speechwriter and a man who's mad about language. Poppy King on Wednesday, and film director Scott Hicks on Thursday. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Damien is next after the news.
This feature was produced by ABC Classic FM. You'll find more audio of our programs, along with special features for download, on our website at abc.net.au/classic/audio.